Talk program. My name is David Inch. Glad to have you with us this morning. In this part of the program, we'll be talking about events in Yugoslavia over the past month or so. We've seen an election, a change of government, and it seems the beginning of a change of in the relationship between Serbia, particularly Yugoslavia more generally, and Europe and the United States. Some rather significant changes. We'll try to talk a little bit this morning about what happened, why, to the extent that we can answer that question, and then the future here for Serbia. And our guest on the program is Carol Leff. She's professor of political science at University of Illinois, and she's been with us before to talk about this part of the world and also to talk about Russia. That's her area of study. And we're glad to have her back. And as we talk, of course, questions are welcome. People who are listening, if you'd like to pose a question yourself, you can do that. We just ask people to try to be brief so that we can keep things moving along, but anyone's welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Good morning.
We had seen some interesting things happen there in Yugoslavia over the past few weeks. There was an election. It was won by Vojislav Koštunica, who was a candidate of a coalition of 18 parties. It was obvious that when he had won, Mr. Milosevic tried to, I think even before the votes were all counted, when it looked like clearly that he had lost, tried to stop the count, tried to say, well, no, actually, Mr. Koštunica didn't get enough votes. And then when that didn't work and there was popular demonstration in favor of the opposition, then apparently Mr. Milosevic decided that force was called for, and probably we would have seen a different outcome if the security forces hadn't decided, no, they weren't going to do that. What made all this possible, particularly the maybe not so much the vote for Mr. Koštunica, but the fact that people who previously had supported Slobodan Milosevic apparently decided they weren't going to do it anymore.
Yeah. Well, of course, that was the $64,000 question. Well, actually, I guess these days it's $1 million question. And the public in Serbia finally gave their final answer. But yeah, I think it is rather complicated, and it was rather complicated for the players too, because I think one question, although they might not all have posed it that way, is the question of, was this Romania in 1989, in which a series of massive popular demonstrations ended up in not only protesting the regime, but in convincing a lot of stalwarts of the Romanian dictator Ceausescu to switch sides, the army in particular? Or was this 1996, 1997 in Serbia, where massive public demonstrations to try to enforce the results of, especially of local elections that Milosevic was ignoring, or announcing that the regime had won? In that case, although some concessions were made on the elections, there was no shaking of the support of Milosevic by the key forces, the security police, the armed forces, and so forth. I just want to make the point, it's only clear now after the fact, which kind of scenario it was, and that posed a very very grave dilemma for the forces, the Democratic Coalition, the 18-party Democratic Coalition you mentioned, that had supported Koštunica and who had to decide, because the issue was not simply whether they would protest. The issue was, you mentioned part of the maneuvering Milosevic went through. Well, Yugoslavia has a presidential election system like the French. There are two rounds. If you win 50% in the first round, then you win outright. If you do not win 50%, but you're one of the top two, you can go on to a second round where in this case, the Milosevic and Koštunica would have faced off. So one of the things that Milosevic said after he said that he didn't that Kostinitsa hadn't won. And then he said, well, yes, he'd gotten more votes, but not enough, just barely not enough to top 50%. So there'd have to be a second round. And I think that was the moment of truth. And the thing that, and I think a lot of Western observers, myself included, were worried about what would happen then. Because what the anti-Milosevic forces decided to do was to announce they were going to boycott that second round and that they were going to stand on the fact that they'd already won and would not jump through more hoops for Milosevic. And, you know, I know beforehand, you know, I was worried about that strategy. I could see they boycott the election, which of course means Milosevic wins it, and you know, and there you are. You have him back in power, and he's been legitimated in a way, you know, that you know that would allow him to coast on for, you know, another few years, and you know that outcome was quite distressing, particularly for reasons we can probably go into later. The electoral politics and strategy of this election were even more complicated than that, because there was a parliamentary election as well at the same time.
Well, one of the things that certainly I was interested in is the fact that there it did seem that people in the military and the security apparatus that previously had been supporters of Milosevic withdrew their support and came out in favor of the opposition. And when was relying on the fact that he could call them into the streets to go against the opposition supporters, they basically they stayed home. What led them to change their mind about supporting Milosevic?
Well, if we could be sure about that, then there wouldn't have been this quandary about what strategy to adopt, because everyone would have been fairly sure that it was not risky to refuse a second round election. But it would appear that several things were different this time than in the past. For one thing, the election itself, up until this September. Milosevic had run for president before and won, and the opposition had never been able to get its act together to support a single candidate that had credibility, that everyone was willing to vote for. And so there was always a fragmented message, and Milosevic won. Okay? And he, you know, certainly the results were messed with in previous elections, but nonetheless, the balance this time and the way in which the opposition united made the message much clearer. So that has to be considered as one unusual fact, and it suggests that the weakness and the fragmentation of Milosevic's opposition was always part of the reason why he could stay on. Second thing is, I think that things from year to year have only gotten worse in Yugoslavia. The economy has continued to deteriorate. Although there were various moments when it might have been hoped that Milosevic, still at the helm, could have negotiated some kind of exit from a number of the sanctions and non-recognitions that Yugoslavia is subject to, I think by the year 2000 it's become fairly plain, and other countries have made it fairly plain, that he's not going to be part of the solution, and I think that message also was clear to people. One of the things that in this election that Kostinitsa said, and he is himself, we haven't talked about him yet, but I'm sure we will, a nationalist, was that Milosevic was a man of the past, which is a message that I think that a number of people, including opportunists or even former loyalists of his, a message that a number of officials could accept and feel calculate that the moment had come where public anti-Milosevic sentiment was fairly clear and where the payoffs for staying in his camp were fairly unclear. Okay, and asking the police to engage in bloody repression at this particular point was asking a bit too much, whatever their personal sentiments might be. And quite a few of them were anti-Milosevic themselves. But, there is this moment in a number of transitions where the military and security forces have to decide which side they're on, and you can't always tell it's coming. But you know, I think those were some of the factors anyway.
It seems too that for someone who had the reputation of, and I'm talking about here about Mr. Milosevic, of being a savvy politician, that he somehow lost touch with the public mood, and that some of the things that I've read suggest that particularly a lot of the people who were in his inner circle continued to tell him everything was great. And if someone, and apparently very few people did, might have come along and said, well, you know, maybe things aren't so great, that person was gone. So yeah. it sounds as if perhaps he, the kind of advice and support that he was getting wasn't being straight with him, and either he was, you know, perhaps choosing to believe that everything was okay when it wasn't, and that he didn't in fact have his pulse very closely on the pulse of the people.
Yeah, well, that's important because this was a challenge he didn't have to face right now. He didn't have to have an election this fall. He could have waited. There was still time on the, you know, on the electoral clock, so to speak. Next summer was really the end point for a new president. That's when his term expired, and all of the elections would have had to be held earlier. They wouldn't have had to be held this much earlier. So he really did miscalculate in deciding this was a time. And in this respect, he clearly had lost the pulse of the public. But he wasn't missing one thing that's still true, which is that the fact that the Serbs and some Montenegrins, we can get to that, but a number of Montenegrins that make up the smaller republic within Yugoslavia did not vote in this election, boycotted it. But the people who were voting against him, who were voting for Kostunica, not all of them were completely out of sympathy with a number of his messages, including, and I think this is very important, you know, deep resentment of the aftermath of the NATO and U.S. incursion on what is recognized even by us as Yugoslav territory in Kosovo last year, which meant that unless those nationalist clothes could be stolen from him, I mean, he had an issue in which he had much in common with the public, because Serbians do see themselves as victims, of a bombing campaign that may have achieved its immediate ends, but I mean, it's still part of the complicated situation there, and still a lot of public resentment of Americans and West Europeans.
Let me just mention here that our guest is on this part of Focus 580, Carol Leff, professor of political science at University of Illinois. We're talking about Yugoslavia and what has happened there in the last month or so. If you have questions, you can call 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Apparently, Mr. Kostunica was a good candidate for the opposition to settle on, someone who was well-known and clearly known as a Milosevic opponent. And someone who had an reputation as being a clean guy, and at the same time probably was sufficiently nationalist enough. He had been apparently a very outspoken critic of the NATO bombing in the Kosovo War, and so was probably occupied enough of a middle ground so that it turned out he was a pretty good candidate, but. To what extent is he truly a Serb nationalist, and is that something that's likely to be a difficulty when we get more and more into trying to patch up again the relationship between Serbia and the West?
Yeah, he says he's a Serb nationalist. I mean, it's not some kind of careful decoding we have to do. I mean, I think that I'll try to remember to go back to your question about what this will mean for us later on, because it means a lot for a number of people who, including not only us, not only West Europe, but for the whole region. But I mean, I just want to go back to the kind of nationalist he was. I don't think that we need to doubt at all the intensity or sincerity of his nationalism, which incidentally is ironic because Milosevic was almost certainly, largely an opportunist on this issue. Milosevic had been a Communist Party official, and this was his ticket to the top of the leadership structure of what's now called the socialists. Actually, I think they may even, you know, there's some name changing going on right now, as a matter of fact. But what was until this month called the socialists. But Koshunitsa belonged to what you might call the innocent Serb nationalism of the 80s. By which I say innocent in the sense that they were profoundly angry at the way Yugoslavia had sold out the Serbs in various ways, had felt that Tito himself, as a Croatian-Slovene ethnic mixture, and as someone who had emphasized the, you know, a federal and multinational state, had systematically compromised the Serbian position. Well, there are a whole group of them, historians, intellectuals. In the case of Koštunica, he was a constitutional legal expert. Mm. But I call them innocent in the sense that you could not, I mean, although they provided an intellectual context that, in fact, Milosevic built on, none of them, you know, and especially Koštunica himself, had not extrapolated into the kind of thing that Milosevic was actually willing to do. I mean, in other words, he is understood to be a constitutional legal expert who takes law and remaining within boundaries of law rather seriously, so that it's not so much his nationalism that makes him distinctive, because I think only a nationalist candidate could have credibly opposed Milosevic. Even so, Milosevic accused him of being the lapdog of the West, and Milosevic's supporters accused him of being in the pay of the West. So I mean, it was anyone who ran against Milosevic would have to be a credible nationalist. The issue that we should recognize is that he was a critic of Kosovo, the NATO action in Kosovo, but also a critic of a number of things Milosevic did. Of the excesses of the Milosevic period. Hmm. Okay. What that means for us, what that means for everybody, that was the other thing you said.
Yeah, at least three sorts of things come up, the relationship between essentially Serbia and Montenegro, which is now what's left of Yugoslavia,
yeah, right.
Between Serbia and Kosovo, and mm-hmm. between Serbia and Bosnia. Mm-hmm. At least he said some things about Kosovo, and seemed to be saying, well, yeah, maybe we did some things that were wrong. He's talked about releasing Albanians that are in jail in Serbia. He's mm-hmm. been to Bosnia. Things still don't seem to be real great as far as the Montenegrins go. They still mm-hmm. are talking about they want to go. Here again, three very difficult sorts of things, and at least are now seem to be kind of on the table.
Yeah, well, just think before the elections. I mean, now, I think that because of the high profile, everybody knows of the considerable Western sympathy for the Kosovar Albanians and for the way they were were treated within Milosevic's Yugoslavia. And what may be less visible in general, because it certainly doesn't make the front pages of the New York Times, is the relationship between the sympathetic Western support for the tiny Second Republic of Yugoslavia. If the Serbia makes up about, depending on whether you count refugees and so forth, let's just say about 9 million people. Montenegro, the other unit of Yugoslavia, is maybe 650,000. I mean, there's a huge disproportion between the size of the two units. Well, a couple of years ago, a Milosevic lieutenant in Montenegro, that is someone that Milosevic had installed with his approval as prime minister in Montenegro, and worked in collaboration with a very young, at that time, the youngest prime minister in Europe, a man named Milo Zhukanovic. Was in the early 90s a supporter of Milosevic, and 2 years ago, after a period in which he had been critical of him on various regards, he came out openly to challenge the Milosevic leadership ran for president in Montenegro and won narrowly against a Milosevic-supported supported politician who is now in the federal government. Okay, and that and then struck out this young Djukanovic, this young, now I guess he's about 38, 37, this young economist staked out a position of pro-democracy, pro-reform, anti-Milosevic positioning. And on that basis, was attracting some Western aid, although it was tricky since it wasn't a country and you couldn't get IMF support or World Bank support. And so there he stood. And with each passing month, as long as Milosevic was in charge in, you know, at the state level, yes, he was moving toward greater independence. He had freed the currency in Montenegro from the Yugoslav currency and was pegging it to the mark, Deutschmark. He was treating with the West. And for him and for the Kosovar Albanians and for Montenegrins who favored independence and pulling away from Serbia, Koštunica's victory is actually a real problem, because now the Western sympathy and attention shifts over to the 9 million strong Serbian Republic with its democratically elected leader, and the chances that either the Kosovars, Albanians, or the Montenegrins could easily get out of Yugoslavia now have been radically reduced compared to when they had Milosevic as the enemy. So there actually are a number of those smaller peoples within the boundaries of Yugoslavia who find this election a very, very mixed blessing. On the one hand, someone who is unlikely to launch a coup d'etat against them or engage in ethnic cleansing. On the other hand, someone whose credibility is such that the West is certainly not going to encourage Kosovar Albanians to think about independence. We've always, in any case, said that we want a solution within Yugoslavia. We want Montenegro's independence advocates to cool it. I mean, so that's one dimension of this, that it's this peculiar reversal, which comes with, you know, who the good guys are for us at any given time and who the former good guys, you know, the kind of priority we attach to the, you know, our previous, I don't want to call them clients, but. Mm.
He also, he went to Bosnia and met with the Muslim, Croat, and Serb members of the collective presidency there. And it was the first time that a leader of Yugoslavia had gone into non-Serb Bosnian territory since the Bosnian War started in 1992. So this was a significant event.
Yeah, right.
And people talked about, well, what does exactly this mean? Does this mean there we'll see improved relations between Bosnia and Belgrade?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's a prospect. But, of course, that whole episode that you described, you probably know, is a little more complicated than that. It started with the return of the body of a Serbian nationalist poet who was to be buried in Bosnia. And Koštunica said he had long since, well before even thought of running for presidency, because remember, of course, that the strategic decision as to who to run as the candidate was a recent one, because the idea that the election was coming up, you know, was a recent one. So he was going to, come hell or high water, he was going to go into Bosnian Serb territory to this Serbian Orthodox ceremony of interment. And at that point, that's very tricky and delicate and possibly nationalistically volatile. At that point, the West, and especially through the French envoys, persuaded him that he was going to make that symbolic gesture to sort of strip it of the possible message that it might send, that he's, what his real text is, that he wants Bosnian Serbian territory back or something. He was encouraged to meet with the national state leadership of Bosnia, and they did so, not in Sarajevo itself, but at the airport. He didn't actually go into Sarajevo. I mean, for various reasons, that's probably the correct security decision. So he talked with them and opened channels of communication. But I think that the whole episode is sort of a good example of the two-sided coin here, that on the one hand, a legitimate Serbian leader in Belgrade can can help normalize relations. On the other hand, you know, it reopens some questions, and you know, knowing that he's a nationalist, it has its potentially destabilizing side too, until he clearly articulates where he stands on a number of issues. The West was very anxious that he make clear he was not trying to overturn the Dayton settlement, which he has in fact publicly acknowledged to be valid. Okay. I mean, Milosevic, after all, signed it. No constitutional legal expert would ignore that, I guess.
What about Kosovo? Certainly, Mr. Koštunica and I'm sure other people in Serbia have no interest in or would be unwilling to see Kosovo become independent.
Yes.
And at the same time, they seem to be somewhat willing to admit that in the previous policies of the government, mistakes were made. So where does one go now with or how does one think about what the relationship is likely to be now between Serbia and Kosovo?
Yeah. Well, as we were saying before, on the one hand, the West has never encouraged or made it as the public policy posture of the West, let's say, has always officially been that Kosovo is part of Yugoslavia but needs to be treated better, in particular needs to gain greater autonomy. And we were obviously willing to think about, even officially, perhaps the kind of substantial autonomy that would be very loose, you know, very loose confederation. Which is the same kind of thing Montenegro was talking about too, as its negotiating posture. Okay, it wasn't as if before this election we had already been backing Kosovar-Albanian independence in that area, but obviously this, and equally clearly, Koštunica is someone who does not want to barter that territory, and he feels the pull of the nationalist historical. I'm about to say mythology, but I mean that in the sense that we also have a patriotic mythology. I don't mean whether it's true or false, but just the way the sentiments that people feel toward a region that was historically part of the heartland of Serbia, over centuries. This makes it difficult he is clearly willing to make gestures of conciliation toward the Albanians in that area. They've clearly gone way past that. Okay? It's been years since the bulk of Albanian opinion in that area was really willing to think about a Kosovo that is still in some way subordinate to Belgrade. So, I mean, that's still a standoff. I mean, and the Albanian position is undermined by having a more credible leader in Belgrade. It's also undermined by the fact that over the period since the ending of the official conflict, the official ending of the NATO conflict and the placement of peacekeepers, Kosovo has not been a quiet transitional state. I mean, the international forces of various sorts continue to do a lot of the governmental functions. There's still a lot of tension. A lot of Serbs have fled. The Albanians, the anger of Albanians against what happened to them has spilled over in various ways. Not all of them. I mean, there are a couple of key conflict zones, but it's not. It's not an orderly picture. There's nobody who can step forward and say that we've got this sorted out and we're ready for self-government. Without even analyzing why all this might be true, it's not, we are not dealing with a coherent side there yet. The whole area continues to be, tense and it's domestic control unclear.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and that's interesting. That goes back to the point that you made about now how, in fact, with Mr. Koštunica now taking over, it actually makes things more complicated because before, when Milosevic was there, one could look at the continuing confusion and difficulty and that was going on in Kosovo and saying, well, we'll deal with that at another point.
Yeah,
we're almost saying that we can put that away. Yeah, right. We can put that aside. But now you can't
right.
say, oh, well, we'll put that aside.
Right. Right.
And I'm sure that much more attention will be focused on there and that there'll be more pressure on Kosovo to kind of get its act together. And that's going to be some task.
Yeah, yeah. And there'll also be lots of pressure. I mean, Kosunice is in the middle of a lot of cross pressures. He wants to rejoin Europe. He wants, you know, sanctions lifted. He wants to normalize all the relationships. And we don't, you know, you look at this, you can see various Western countries not wanting to press him too far. But still, there's all this outstanding agenda. And eventually, he's going to have to deal with it. And the West is going to have to deal with it because we're in there. I mean, we're inside the boundaries of Yugoslavia with various peacekeeping forces, and you know, that means, well, I mean, we may not be. It depends. I mean, I don't know what what George W. Bush's plan, should he be elected, is. I mean, he has come out, you know, to talk about the future policy postures, saying that we ought not to be in the Balkans, that NATO, European NATO forces, ought to take care of Europe and the Balkans, and we'll do the big jobs elsewhere. And, I mean, our allies were taken back by that, but, I mean, I'm not sure what it means, but you know, that's yet another sort of joker in the deck. We don't really know what the American election might mean for a Balkan policy.
Okay. Our guest this morning here on Focus, Carol Left, mm-hmm. She's a professor of political science at University of Illinois. We have a caller here. Get to others. Welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Caller here is in Aurora, and that's line 4. Hello.
Yes, I have friends that are Croatian, and of course they're very unhappy about what happens in Yugoslavia. Tito was the unifying factor in Yugoslavia at one time. I'll ask you two questions and then hang up. What would be the unifying factor now, and do you think Tito will ever be charged for his war crimes? Thank you.
Okay. Is there a unifying factor in Yugoslavia now? It was the first question. You know, I don't really think it would ever be possible. I mean, Tito had a rather unique position because, among other things, he was the organizer during World War II of a partisan force that resisted the German outsiders. I mean, and as complicated as the political situation was in Yugoslavia during the war, ultimately, when Germany was defeated, there was an organized military and political force that had fought the Germans, that was recognized by the West, and that was also keeping the Soviet Union out. And he was, in addition, a Croatian and a Slovene by background, and he had around him a number of lieutenants from all forces. But the liberation mythology, the fact that he came to power as a unifier and protector of Yugoslavia, I don't see how anyone else could reproduce that role. Okay. So I can't imagine anyone with that kind of credibility, even within rump Yugoslavia now. Now, the question of whether...
I think the question was whether
Milosevic.
Yes, and,
right.
No,
right. Because she was talking about Tito.
As there are so many names here...
That's right. Yeah,
we can all be forgiven for confusing names.
Right, right, right.
That indeed is a question. Mr. Kostunica apparently has said some things about the possibility of putting Mr. Milosevic on trial in Yugoslavia, not handing him over to the war crimes trial, but doing something there at home. So, what do we think is likely to happen to Mr. Milosevic now?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, you know, just to start at the beginning, he is a formally indicted by the Hague War Crimes Tribunal for ethnic cleansing policies for a range of issues, and I don't think the book might be closed on that in terms of what he might be charged with. Okay, that's point one. Point two, the West and various, the EU in general and individual Western governments are rather reluctant to charge him to push Kostinitsa to move forward on this issue and to turn him over. He has explicitly said he does not want to turn him over to the War Crimes Tribunal, although apparently in recent days there's been a suggestion that that may not be a blanket, refusal to cooperate with the tribunal at all. And the suggestion that Kostunica might allow for a trial within Serbia or within Yugoslavia for his war crimes has been suggested, and there's been an indication in the West, some diplomatic back channels and some off the record comments, that this might be the compromise. But if so, it's a rather complex compromise, because if you listen to Kostinica, or rather a number of Serbian nationalists, one of the things you will hear is that the emphasis tends to be a bit more on how he drags Serbia down and a bit less on the larger issues of what happened to some other peoples within Yugoslavia and his connection to that. So it wouldn't be precisely the same. But in terms of the art of the possible, I mean, I think that if Western leaders are actually willing to allow a domestic process to go forward, then it may well be that that's what happens. So I think I don't think it's necessarily clear that he won't meet justice, but I think it's very unclear that he'll meet justice at The Hague at this point. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I think that may stay unclear for a number of months. The new democratic parliamentary elections are supposed to be held in December. And at the moment, Kostunica doesn't even have a government to work with that isn't basically the Milosevic crew.
Well, this – and it goes back to your raising issue or just mentioning in passing Romania. And at the time that all this was going on in Yugoslavia, there were the popular demonstrations, and finally we saw Mr. Milosevic sort of apparently accept the inevitable and step aside. In some of the commentary, some of the descriptions, I also heard references to Romania. And mm-hmm. I think back to that and think to what I, at least in the couple of years after Ceausescu was gone, I heard people say that, well, it's true that Ceausescu was gone, but other than that, the people who had been running the country before were still mm-hmm. running the country. Mm-hmm. And it made me wonder here, in this context, in terms of Yugoslavia, whether in just how much, when you look at the people who were in positions of power, how much really has changed. Yes, we've replaced Milosevic with Kostunica, but what about what about everybody else, the other people who essentially run the state, bureaucrats and other sorts of people?
Yeah, and that's a very important question, because it's not just a matter of whether the old faces are going to go, but in part because of the sanctions and the prolonged rule of one man, the combination. Yugoslavia is incredibly corrupt, and it's not just individual office holders, but a whole network of patronage and contraband smuggling and energy smuggling. The economy, the people who boomed in this economy, we might think of them as war profiteers, and a lot of them are embedded in that governmental structure. And some of the most visible ones include the Milosevic's son Marko. And in addition to Milosevic and his crew, there is Milosevic's wife, who had her own party, her own smaller party, and her own network of influence and issues. She was actually, I think, much more disliked than he was, which on the one hand is because her party was more hard radical, but on the other hand is because I think this is not uncommon in a lot of, you look at a marriage like this, and a woman in a political marriage has real credibility problems at some times. We've seen them in the United States, but certainly in a number of other countries. When Raisa Gorbachev, for example, tried to have a higher profile, that was not appreciated either. There's a lot still to be done. Most of the key offices, including interior security issues, although the Milosevic forces have agreed to sort of share the government until the elections, Kostunica does not have control of this apparatus, and there's still a tremendous number of people who you know, have other agendas or carryover agendas, some of whom may be cheerfully willing to just switch sides or may have always wished to switch sides. You know, the media is like that. Some people are disgusted at the way the media just rolled over and said, now we're Democratic. But in many cases, a lot of them are pretty unhappy, you know, with their jobs. But in a country with that much unemployment, you know, I don't know what my moral fiber would be if I had a family and you know, this was the only job that a journalist could do.
Hmm. Well, in response to the victory of Mr. Kushnin, it's President Clinton began lifting sanctions against Yugoslavia. This happened, I guess, about 10 days ago. And Mr. Kushnitsa said he was ready to try to begin to normalize relations or resume normal diplomatic relations between his country and the United States. Where now do you think things are headed in this particular relationship between the Yugoslavia and the United States?
Well, I mean, in the first instance, of course, we're undergoing a transition too. And certain, by the time, you know, in a couple of weeks, it will be clear who the next president will be. And that will make some difference because I don't think we can assume that the policies would necessarily be identical. Mm-hmm. They're probably not going to be as different as the Bush statement on, you know, on not doing anything in, you know, letting Europe do the peacekeeping and us do the big stuff. But still, I mean, I think that there's, you know, there is going to be a, you know, a difference in emphasis about, you know, about what we might do there and how far we might go there. I think that, you know, so I don't, you know, where are we going to go on this? I mean, I think that's one issue. I think the first step that probably is going to happen, no matter who's in power where, is that there's going to be a return of Yugoslavia at international institutions. You know, the UN, the IMF, they've already been, they had been suspended from the continent-wide, actually Eurasian, Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe. And you know, now they're, you know, now going to return to that. So there are a series of organizations that even without European integration, that they were the only post-communist country were not involved in a series of organizations. That's good. The return to institutions is going to be first. And part of the reason why they can now join the UN is that up until now, Milosevic had always claimed to be the successor, his regime to be the successor state of Yugoslavia as a whole, and no one would buy that. Quite apart from, you know, the other policy issues that were involved. One thing that I, you know, like to bring up because it's specifically relevant to the transition, and it will come a few weeks later with a little greater clarity. Incidentally, this year I'm the acting director of the Russian East European Center, and there are a few forums coming up which we are either sponsoring or co-sponsoring. One in particular, you know, I'd like to be sure to mention. Sure. On November 15th.
Yes, please.
Okay. On that day, we're bringing in with the European Union Center and the Arms Control Program and you know, a few other sponsors, so panelists of experts on this conflict. Professor Robin Remington, who I think has been on this program
yes.
more than once,
Number
but at least
times.
Once. Yeah. Who is a specialist on Yugoslavia and in fact was there during the election campaign and the demonstrations, you know, before things were resolved. We also hope to bring in, you know, I think this is settled, but I'm not positive. We also expect to bring in a representative of the European Union, one of the delegation, EU delegation in Washington, to come out here. I think the official who's coming is Jonathan Davidson, and he will be able to talk a bit about the intricacies of negotiating with the new government and the intricacies, you know, what the issues will be, what the European Union is prepared to do. I'm going to say a little bit about comparative transitions, but the value added is clearly with our two visitors, and that's November 15th. It's going to be at Levis Faculty Center in the evening, 7 o'clock, on the third floor. A couple of slightly less directly related issues. Two U of I students, undergraduates, contributed to a summer in Kosovo in which a documentary was made. I think they also have been on your program,
yes,
Jeff Norman and Sarah Price.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're doing an ACTUS forum on November 8th at 4 o'clock in which they talk a little bit about their experience. So there's another angle on the whole issue. And finally, this afternoon, at 4 o'clock in the International Studies Building at 910 South Fifth Street, a public lecture by Harvard University anthropologist Michael Hertzfeld. He's going to talk about the Bosnian battlefields, but he is not military strategy. He's an anthropologist, so he's going to look at and this is a 20th century view of the issue. He's a cultural anthropologist, and I think that also might be an interesting piece of the puzzle over the next few weeks.
Sure, very good. So. Well, we have one caller here. We'd like to get in. No, that's good. I think it's good for people to know about events like these. People who are in and around town might want to take them in. Here's caller in Rantoul, line one. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
As we try to restore this area of the world back into the family of nations and restore economic viability, I was wondering if your guests would like to comment. NATO's, Great Britain's, and the U.S.'s responsibility to clean up all the uranium contamination and the other contamination from collateral damage during the war. Peter Avisto and the United Nations are obviously looking at this right now, but it's a significant issue because before economic viability can be restored, all the wholesale environmental contamination probably needs to be cleaned up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's broader actually than that. In the sense that, for example, one of the economic lifelines of the Serbian and Yugoslavian economy in general, but particularly for Serbia, is the Danube. And the Danube, which was perfectly traversable 6 months before the conflict, I know because I actually did it, but at that time, bridges have been destroyed, and although some of them have been rebuilt, and Milosevic put a lot of energy into this, in fact, his rebuilding program was one of the things that sort of reinforced the pronounced ambivalence about the whole situation. I mean, there's the question of commercial traffic on the Danube. There's the question of a number of transportation linkages that are less important than the Danube itself. In addition to environmental damage, now the legal means by which our responsibility, what I suspect will happen is that it will not be the case that the West says, I'm sorry, we were very culpable and we'll fix what we did. But this will all be folded into whatever aid packages are addressed. And the distinction between that which happened as a result of the NATO bombing and that which happened as a result of 10 years of sanctions and so forth and Milosevic's rule will not be front and center.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to have to interrupt you, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to just because we've used the time we have at this point, and I appreciate the comments of the callers. I'm sure we'll be talking about this some more in the future, but for the moment we say to our guest, Carol Laff, professor of political science here at U of I, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.